Okay, so the end of Hazinu, a very, very emotional aliyah, and very, it's brief, but it's very filled with content, and it's containing many significant statements and themes that are relevant all year round and are relevant especially around this time of year. So let's try to see what we can glean in the next few minutes from these psukim, which really represent the end of Moshe Rabbeinu's life and the key messages that he wants to leave us with. So the pasuk begins, pasuk mem dalet, v'yavo Moshe, v'yadaber es kol divrei hashira hazos v'ozne ha'am, hu v'hoshe bin Nun. So he went to convey, as Mefarshim explained, not just to say, but to make sure that all of the messages of the Torah are understood by the people, to bring them into the ears of the people, him and Hoshea ben Nun. So of course it's interesting that we thought the name Hoshea was behind him and that he's now Yehoshua. So the usage of the name Hoshea is interesting. Rashi has a comment here for the Sefrei that even though Yehoshua was to be his successor, nonetheless, he still was functioning right now as a Talmud. So therefore, he's keeping his youthful name for this pasuk. That's what it sounds like. It's interesting that if you look at Naznayim LaTorah, he has a kind of opposite perspective. It shows you a little bit how sometimes Drosh can work. It takes the same idea and flips it around. That this is to signify the transition, that here very soon Yehoshua is going to be taking over. So therefore there's a one-time reference of him as Hoshea to signify his independent identity before his rabbi changed his name. It was Moshe who changed his name. So in order to show that he is going to be a leader on his own now, so the pasuk refers to him by the name before he was changed by Moshe. So it's kind of the opposite of what Rashi said. Rashi is emphasizing that he didn't let his impending leadership change his mindset, therefore his youthful name is used. And here's another way of emphasizing a different perspective. Okay, so in any event, so they go around and they convey all the messages. And Vayechal Moshe L'daber es kol hadvarim ha'ela al kol Yisrael. Moshe finished speaking all of these words to the Jewish people, and he leaves them with another core message. Vayomer aleihem. Simu levavchem l'chol hadvarim asher anochi meir bochem hayom asher titzavum es b'neichem l'shmor la'asos es kol divrei ha'Torah hazos. Simu levavchem, what does this mean? Simu levavchem, how do you translate that? What does it mean in contemporary Hebrew? Place your heart, very literally, right? So more idiomatically, it means to pay attention. And that seems to be the point here, that Moshe is emphasizing that I can do whatever I do, I can give you whatever I give you, and it can be the greatest message in the world, and it can be the most powerful content out there, but if you're not going to pay attention, it's not going to make a difference. That the role is ours to make sure that we are focusing, and it takes a tremendous amount of focus, and sometimes we don't realize how distracted we are. And there's a lot written about this, and I'll just recommend, for example, Rav Nevensal in the Sichas over here in Dvarim, Parshas Hazinu has a lengthy Sicha about this point, where he emphasizes just how crucial our attention is to the whole process of learning anything, because if we are not going to try to invest our awareness in what's being presented, then we're not going to get anything. It's not going to make a difference to us. And we're not always cognizant of just what kind of things can distract us. That even unlearning, for example, so we can get very involved in the lumdus of the sugya and very taken by the intellectual challenge that's involved, and it can escape us the message that it's meant to have on our personality. And we all know about how it's possible to be involved in a mitzvah, to be involved in a musar shmuz even, and to walk away and be the exact same, to not have the message enter into your heart at all. And sometimes, I'm sure we all have our own funniest stories about how we're completely missing the point of whatever it is that's right in front of us. And that's essentially always possible, but unless we're going to be som lev, unless we bring that power of concentration and integration into the process, indeed, that's what's going to happen. It's going to escape us. It's going to miss us. And therefore, everything else is for nothing. The next pasuk really continues this theme in a way, and is a very well-known pasuk, where the Torah tells us, "Ki lo davar reku mikem, ki hu chayechem, uvedavar hazeh tarichu yamim al ha'adama asher atem ovrim esayardein shomel rishta." Because this is not something which is rake. This is not something which is empty. Because this is your life. And this is what will give you length of life, al ha'adama, that you are about to enter. So the phrase, lo davar reku mikem, attracts the attention of Chazal. And the Yerushalmi has a statement, also a pretty well-known statement, that if there's anything that seems to you like it's empty, if there's something that seems like it's not important, that's from you. Mikemhu. That's your responsibility, that you are missing it. And Rashi here quotes, without quoting that line directly, that the idea, lo davar reik, that clearly the Torah is not empty, but not only is it not empty in its totality, but none of it is empty. All of it is filled with content and with meaning and with significance. And if you're not seeing that, it's because we can. It's because you are not putting in the necessary effort and not investing in yourself, again, it's a continuation from the previous pasuk, in order to see what there is that is contained within this pasuk, contained within this part of the Torah, and every other part of the Torah. So here Rashi quotes as an example. So look at Rashi, says, Teidu lecha, shekein amru chachamim v'achos lota and timna, v'simna haisa pilegesh, that we have these references to timna, to this pilegesh, v'fisha amra, eini kedai li oslo isha, halavai v'e pilagsho. So here, Rashi's not telling us the whole story, it's the Gemara in Sanhedrin and elsewhere, that there was this woman, Timna, who wanted to marry into the family of Avram. She ends up marrying Eliphaz as a kind of consolation prize. She thought that she could be a pilegesh to the Avos. And Avram sends her away for whatever reason. And the Gemara says that her rejection was what led to her ultimately being the matriarch of Amalek. And that we end up having Tzaras from Amalek forever because of her being rejected, which is a powerful idea to reflect upon. But here, where Rashi wants to focus on, Lohodia Shvacho Shel Avram, Sheyesholtonim Umelachim Misavim Lidavek Bizarro, that we see that Avram had such influence and impact on the world that even somebody like her, who came from royalty and came from non-Jewish royalty, wanted to cleave to the Jewish people. And that's a very powerful statement. So it sounds like what Rashi is telling us is that this is an example of something which seems like it's so extraneous, seems like it's just a detail that doesn't really have much significance. And no, the Torah is telling us this to show how much Avram influenced the world. Rav Schwab takes this a little bit further, and he notes that you see that there was tremendous potential in this woman, Timna, even though it ended up going in a different direction, and that's where Amalek was nourished from, was from her tremendous spiritual power, which ended up being directed away from us and against us. But we also were told that the ability of Amalek to address us in a negative way was because of that first attack of Rafu Yudeim and HaTorah. The Jews had weakened their commitment to the Torah, and therefore Amalek was able to attack. So therefore we have to counter that with greater commitment to the Torah. So he finds that to contain symbolism as well, that Imreku Mikem, that if there's emptiness, it's because we are finding it empty, because we are not properly committed, and that's where we find that we're vulnerable to all kinds of other uses of the kochos that otherwise could have been harnessed for tremendous goodness and positivity in the world. There is also a Tanit de Be'elio, which the Paras Yosef HaChodesh quotes, and I think it actually ties in a little bit to a comment that we made yesterday, that there's a mashal the Tanit de Be'elio gives. So sometimes people will say, listen, I'm not very involved in learning, and I don't try too much, because I don't have the keichas for it. I don't have any talent for learning. God didn't give me any. Didn't give me a proclivity and the ability to learn well. So in this mashal, so the person who says this is asked, well, tell me, what do you do? So he says he's a hunter. And he displays the whole elaborate plan and difficult strategies he has to trap animals. So then the question comes to him, okay, well, how did you do all that? So he says, well, this is what I am naturally able to do. This is my talent. This is what God has given me. So then the response is, okay, if you can do all that, then you can be learning also. So don't come and say to me that, well, I'm not learning because I don't have any God-given ability. You see, you do have God-given ability. You're just using it for other things. You just are directing it in other ways. And in that sense, the reading would be, Eg lo davareku mikam. You're not empty because God didn't give you anything. It's you. You decided that this isn't something you're going to apply yourself to. And that's why you feel like there is emptiness here, but not because it's actually empty in and of itself, even in the sense of your ability to confront it. And this, I think, relates to what we said yesterday. We made a comment talking about the challenging nature of the material. We're learning yesterday about the Erevin-related material and just how difficult it is, and about how various sections of the Talmud are considered to be particularly difficult. Then I went on to say about how the Torah is so broad that there's all kinds of different material, and therefore each of us have our own proclivities and inclinations. So some of us find some material very difficult and others to flow much more easily, and others will find what we consider to be difficult to be relatively accessible, while they'll have a harder time with other things. So there's no objectively hard or easy Gemaras. There's that which poses a challenge to each individual differently. And that's a part of the beauty of the Yom HaTalmud. It's so broad that it has enough to be easy and hard for everyone. So for any of us to come and say, well, listen, you can't expect me to learn, I'm just not cut out for it. There's a chelik in Torah for everybody. There is an entrance point that all of us can find. And then take that and work with it. That's our tafkid. So we're told, lo davareku, there's nothing that is outside of us that has nothing waiting for us. If we think that that's mikem, that comes from us, and it's our job to do what we can to make sure that we apply the abilities that we have towards this gift that we have been given. So the next pasuk continues, Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe be'etzem hayom hazeh lemor. So now God is about to tell Moshe, once again, it's not the news, but it's a very difficult message, that he is about to die. He should go up to the mountain, and he is essentially instructed to cooperate in his own death. And not only that aspect, which itself is difficult, but of course, as we know, happening before he has a chance to go into Eretz Yisrael, so it's a particularly emotional and painful kind of experience. So what's the significance here of saying Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh? Why is that highlighted here? And Etzem Hayom Hazeh, we know, usually means during the day, at its midday point, at its brightest, broad daylight. So what's the significance of highlighting that? So Rashi quotes an interesting idea. That Rashi says that essentially what was going on here, that just to note that this happens in a number of places, that you find in the Torah, Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh, in the context of Noach, and he's going into the Teva. And you also find this when the Jews left Mitzrayim. And that there the idea was, in both places, that there were people who said that we're not going to let this happen. We're not going to let Noah get into the Teva. We're not going to let the Jews leave Mitzrayim. We're going to stop it. So God says, you think so? Here, it'll be right in front of your eyes. It's going to be in the middle of the day. And you're still not going to stop it. So here too, Rashi continues, Av Khan Musasal Shal Moshe. Now Marba Etzim Hayom Hazeh. So to here, when Moshe is dying, it says right in the middle of the day, Lefisho Ayisrael Omrim, because the Jews were saying, Bekach Bekach, Im Anu Margishimbo, Ein Anu Manichna, so we're not going to let this happen. Adam Shah Siyom in Mitzrayim, he took us out of Egypt, took Lana Siyam, he split the sea, Behor Lana was Saman, he brought the man for us, because Lana was a Slav. The hell lana was a bear, he gave us the quail, he gave us the well, Venas lana was a Torah, and Yana Manichna, so he gave us the Torah, did all these great things for us, we're not letting him go. So Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, so God says again, Hareini Machnisu Bachatzi Yom, I'm going to bring this out in the middle of the day, and you're not going to be able to stop it. So many of the Mefarshim ask a pretty present question, what could you ask about the comparison here? And so we mentioned Noah getting onto the Teva and the Jews leaving Mitzrayim. So there is a difference between those two cases and this case, right? What's the difference? It's one thing to say you'll block the path to the Teva, you'll block the path to leaving Mitzrayim. What exactly are you going to do to stop Moshe from dying? That's a beautiful thought, but it seems like that's beyond any mob's ability to get in the way. So the Svarim try to figure this out. What exactly was their plan here? What would their plan have been? What would they do to try to keep Moshe in this physical plane? So there are a number of approaches. Just interesting here from a Derech perspective that Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, in one of his shmuzim, so he noted that this is an example of the Koach HaTfilah. You see the tremendous power that Tfilah has. That presumably what they meant is they would have davened like crazy, they would have gotten together and they would have created such a cult tefillah, they would have had such a powerful expression of prayer that that's how they would have planned to keep Moshe alive. That's how they would have stopped Moshe from dying. So the story goes that when the Brisker Rav heard this idea of Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, he said, no, it's a different shot. And this Brisker Rav happens to be quoted in a number of Sfarim. You can find a lot of Talmidim of the Brisker Rav who quote this idea. And essentially, the way it's presented in some of them is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to tell him to go up to the mountain and he's going to die there. So therefore, it says Adin that he can only die on the mountain. So what they'll do is they will stop him from getting on the mountain, and that will stop that from happening. That will keep him alive. So it's recorded that when Reb Chaim Shmulevitz heard that response of the Brisker Rav, he said that the Brisker Rav learns Chumash like the Rambam, and that's not the way to do it. You have to learn Chumash like Chumash, and the Rambam like the Rambam. So to say, is a Brisker Maisa here. It's got to be, this is a din, has to be on the higher, and if you can stop that, then you can stop the Chalois Maisa Misa. It's not a proper way to address this whole situation. So the Sefer Megadim Chadashim, so he notes both opinions, and he notes that there's really support for both opinions here, both presentations of what's going on. It says, if you look in other Midrashim, Sefer Megadim Chadashim, it's a Sefer on a couple of volumes of Chumash, he has on some Masech, there's also contemporary Mechaber. So he notes that there's support for both interpretations in some of the earlier sources. It says, first of all, there are some Midrashim where the language was, we're not going to let him go into that place. So it sounds like, indeed, like the Brisker Rav a little bit, that that's what they were aiming to do, that they would physically get in the way and that that somehow would stop this from happening. That's noteworthy, as it's also brought up, that in the Chumash you don't get any sense of any of this happening, that there was any kind of a mass jump to try to get in the way. But that's one possibility. And it's also noted that, even to say it in a little bit of a less brisker way, But Kadosh Baruch Hu essentially is promising him that, okay, you're not going to get into Eretz Yisrael, but you'll go up and you'll see it from there. So maybe that was the understanding, that this much, if you could keep that from being fulfilled, then you could keep Moshe alive a little longer, and that maybe that was what they intended to do. But in other sources, there is also a support to the idea that it was about the tefillah, and it seems like these are two approaches that exist to what was going on. There are a few other approaches also, that maybe they intended to learn with him, that that would have kept him alive, that's what they were hoping for. So there are a number of suggestions, all to try to explain this idea that sounds like there was a theoretical possibility, even though it wasn't going to work anyway, that was Kadosh Baruch Hu's point, but that there was the theoretical possibility that, comparable to the Teva and to the Jews leaving Mitzrayim, that they could have gotten in the way and they could have stopped Moshe from dying. So in any event, all of this is explained in Rashi before you hear what Moshe is actually told, and that's this very painful content. It says, Ale el har ha'avarim hazeh, har nevo, asher be'eretz Moab, asher al pnei yirecho, ure'ei es eretz Kenan, asher anino sein l'bnei Yisrael achuzo. So go up to the mountain, go up to Har Nevo, which is in the land of Moab, and opposite Yericho, and you'll see Eretz Canaan that I am going to give to the Jewish people as an inheritance. One of the most evocative citations of this in the non-Jewish world was Martin Luther King citing this idea right before he was assassinated. You can find the speech right before he was killed, the night before, I think. He gave a speech where he so powerfully said that he's not worried about what's going to happen to him because he's been to the mountaintop and he's seen the promised land. He evokes this idea that Moshe Rabbeinu was given this last moment where, even though he can't actually enter into the land, but he's given a glimpse of what it's like. So it's a very powerful speech in which this whole concept is evoked. So Moshe is supposed to take a look and see. Umus bahar asher ata ola shama ve'yasef el amecha kasher meis aron achicha b'har ha'har ve'yasef el amav. So this is what you should do. You should go up there and you should die. And you will be gathered up just like Moshe also died on the mountain and he was gathered up. So the suggestion is all the same mountain. The first one tried to figure out exactly how that could work. It's very challenging, the idea that Moshe and Aaron and Miriam all died in the same place, just trying to make that work. It's something the first one tried to figure out a little bit. Or the names, even if you want to say there's many different names, which is what Farshim say, still just to make the details work is something that you find a lot of discussion about. But in any event, so here Moshe is apparently not only going to die, but he has to do so as a mitzvah. They talk about in Farshim also, what does it mean that he is instructed to die? That's something that one has control over. So some talk about this has to do with the idea that he prepared his own burial, or that he essentially put himself into the position that even that, up to the last minute, he was acting as a mitzvah. He was acting to fulfill the mitzvahs of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that even characterized his last moments. So here, these last two psukim, where the parsha ends, again, it's a very, very emotional idea. And in the middle, we're told that this is happening for a reason, that this is happening because of something that Moshe did wrong. And the psukim treated next to psukim together, it says, Al asher ma'altem bi, that you somehow transgressed against me, you somehow didn't do the right thing, b'soch b'nei Yisrael, among the Jewish people, b'mei merivas kadesh midbartzin, al asher lo kidashtem osi b'soch b'nei Yisrael. That you did something wrong at Mei Meriba, that you did not sanctify my name, that you weren't Mekadesh Shem Shemayim amongst the Jewish people, and therefore as a consequence, Ki Mineget Teres Aretz. So you'll see the land opposite you, the Shama Lo Savo, and you're not going to go in. You're not going to actually enter El Aretz, Asher Ani Nosen L'Vnei Yisrael, that I'm giving to the Jewish people, you're not going to see it. And thus ends the second to last parsha in the Torah, the penultimate parsha, just before the closing of Vezos HaBracha. So of course, this is one of the most challenging ideas that we find. What exactly is being referred to here? This Ma'altembi, this Aveira that was so consequential that Moshe Rabbeinu is paying essentially the ultimate price and being deprived of that which he wants the most. And among the difficulties, we don't know with 100% confidence what exactly it's talking about. And that's something which itself provokes a lot of attention. The Rambam in Shmona Prakim writes, this is one of the most difficult things to figure out, L'chumash, what exactly is going on. And if you look, for example, in the Bravanel, he has 10 theories as to what exactly the actual Aveira was. The Shadal notes that the Meforshim here seem to kind of do an injustice to Moshe Rabbeinu, because the Torah says he did one thing wrong, and the Meforshim is trying to figure out what it is. They add another 13 things onto his rap sheet. So here, trying to figure out what the Chumash is saying, unfortunately Moshe has to go through a lot of criticism. There are many different suggestions. And among the suggestions, we have what Rashi here says, that it was the fact that he hit the rock. The Ramban questions it, because it seems like if he wasn't supposed to hit the rock to get the water, so why was he told to take the mate? Why was he told to take the staff? And earlier in the Chumash, he's supposed to hit the rock. So there's a lot that's difficult about this interpretation. And we find many other suggestions. Maybe it was because he hit the rock twice. Maybe it was because of his criticism of the Jewish people, of Shimon HaHamorim. Maybe it was because he made it appear as if he and Aaron were really the ones responsible for bringing out the water. It's really difficult. It's not clear what exactly was the nature of the Aveira here. Schwab comments that the language of Me'ilah is because the Mateh was the same Mateh that Aaron had for the episode of Korach, and therefore it was considered to be hektish, it was sanctified, so to do anything with it, like to hit something with it, so that was an act of Me'ilah. And he notes there the question, which is certainly a very present question, that it's miraculous either way, right? So normally hitting rocks does not result in massive amounts of water flowing out. So if we're looking for a Kiddush Hashem, we're looking for a nes. So okay, so it was a nes. So either way, it was a nes this way, it was a nes that way. I remember many years ago when I was in Yeshiva in Israel, one of my roommates just mentioned a story. I forgot already the details of the story, but the story has a little bit less resonance nowadays in our wireless age. This was already a number of years ago. But in general, even though you could do all kinds of things with technology, that people are always more impressed when you do things without any kind of contact at all. When there's contact, then they can assume, okay, you pushed a button, you triggered something, there's some kind of a process there. When you don't even touch something and you make it happen, so then that's always more impressive. And that maybe that was a very significant Yerida in the Kiddush Hashem that was taking place. Again, nowadays, we're so accustomed to doing everything wirelessly, I don't even know how much of a difference there is when people pull something off without talking to something, without touching something, with touching something. And talking, we know voice activated is also pretty rampant nowadays. I don't know if it's going to have so much of an explanation that you're going to find there. But in any event, so there's a lot of effort in trying to figure out exactly what is the Torah getting at here. And Rabbi J.J. Schachter, in an article that was published in the first volume of Mitocha Ohel, so he notes that, he quotes many of the interpretations, and he notes that thinks that, first of all, whatever the Aveira is, and that's hard enough as it is, but this is a kind of a, I don't know if he makes this point exactly, but he makes a related point, that it's a little ironic, a little striking, that this is what we read, at least this year, we read on Shabbat Shuvah, because it seems like it is undermining the whole message of Shabbat Shuvah. Right here we're saying that it's possible for you to repent, it's possible for you to undo your averos. And here, Moshe Rabbeinu is being told, sorry, you messed up so badly that there's nothing you can do. Nothing that's going to change this situation. No matter how much you daven about it, you're not entering into the land of Israel. And he works off the premise, as others do as well, that it's not so much about the averos shabbos. It was about the leadership that was necessary for the Jewish people. And that, yes, it's true, as the Ramban and others commented, that there was an earlier point in history at the beginning of their trip in the desert where Moshe was told he was supposed to hit the rock. So what's the big difference that now he's hitting the rock? Previous time he was supposed to, now he's not supposed to. Why is that so significant? So, as he notes, it's a question of what type of leadership is necessary at what stage in history. That now, after 40 years in the Midbar, so the Jews have seen enough of God's kindness to them. It's really a topic of our Masechta this year, right? The whole mitzvah of Sukkah, some synergy. The whole mitzvah of Sukkah is to keep that at the forefront of our consciousness. So, at one point, maybe it was true that the Jews needed only to see harsh treatment in order to believe in God's power. But now, at this point in history, what they need is a much softer approach, and they need a leader who is able to see them that way and able to convey the messages necessary in such a demeanor. And Moshe Rabbeinu, whether you can forgive him or not, okay, you can do tshuva, you can forgive him, but he was no longer the leader for the next generation. That's how he understood it. And that the generation that was entering into the land was going to need a different kind of leadership. And to support this point, he quotes a very striking medrash, a medrash which is very hard to really appreciate. You have to really figure out what it's actually saying. It was a medrash that suggests that Moshe Rabbeinu actually could have entered the land had he accepted a different role. That he was told, God said, you can come in, but you can't come in as the leader of the Jewish people. You can come in as a balabas. You can come in as a congregant of Yeshua. Yeshua will be the leader, and you'll be a follower. So then you can enter into the land. So he didn't accept that. Didn't accept that offer. So it's very hard to understand exactly what that medrash is getting at, but it illustrates this point that the issue wasn't that it was some kind of onesh for Moshe necessarily, but it's saying that Moshe was not going to be able to continue in this role as the leader that the Jewish people needed at that time. So that medrash, just to point out a lumdish approach to kind of soften the impact. As difficult as that medrash is, you could perhaps use it to explain a lumdish point, that the Gemara Maseches Sota asks, why was Moshe so heartset on going into the land of Israel? Is it because he wanted the shawarma and the ragalach? The Gemara talks about peiros, but I assume it's the same kind of idea, that he wanted the food of Eretz Israel. Is that why he was so determined to get into the land? So the Gemara says, no, it wasn't that. It was he wanted to fulfill mitzvos. The mitzvos are tzlius baretz that he didn't have any opportunity to do before going into the land. So he wanted to enter in so he could fulfill these mitzvos. So the Gemara, again, there's so much so difficult about these Gemaras. It's hard to relate to them. But the Gemara says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to him, don't worry about it. You're looking for the schar. I'll give you the schar as if you did it, which is a lot to comment on maybe for a different time. But some of the Sfarim ask that seems pretty obvious. You know, why was Moshe so determined to go in to fulfill these mitzvos? We have a concept of onus rachmona patre. We know that if it's impossible for you to do a mitzvah, so you're exempt from the mitzvah. So you could say, ein lecha onus gadol mizeh. Right? No one's ever had a better doctor's note. You know, no one's ever had a better excuse. Here he's begging to go in. And God is saying, no, I'm not going to allow it to happen. So what does he want? Obviously, he's putter from these mitzvos if it's impossible for him to have the opportunity to do it. So how could you blame him for not doing it? So So once the Paris Yosef HaChadash, he quotes from some who explain based on the tshuvas of the Avnei Nezer. Sachshav Rebbe has a tshuva about the idea the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch have that when it comes to the mitzvah of Neres Chanukah, one is obligated to go to the ends of the earth to make sure he can fulfill this mitzvah. That even if you can't afford Ner Chanukah, you have to go begging, you have to knock on doors, you have to sell your clothes, whatever it takes, in order to make sure you can fulfill this mitzvah. So everyone asks, but normally that's not the rule. Normally when it comes to a mitzvah, a lulav, esrog, whatever it is, if it costs more than a fifth of your money, you're not obligated to do it. So how come here, when it comes to Hanukkah, we're being told you gotta really go crazy to be able to fulfill this mitzvah? So the Avnei Nezer suggested that when it comes to other mitzvos, if you can't do it, we say ones, ones rechmana patre, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu understands that you want to do it, but you can't afford it. It costs too much. So therefore, you're off the hook. But when it comes to a mitzvah like Pirsumei Nisa, the mitzvahs of Neres Chanukah is in the category of publicizing miracles. So publicizing miracles, that you can't just rely on onus. That has to actually happen. Why? Because Pirsumei Nisa is about communication. So God can give me credit for mitzvahs that I want to do but I can't do. But let's say I want to light a Hanukkah candle but I can't afford it. So what's going to happen? So people will pass by my house and they'll say, well, he probably wanted to put a Hanukkah candle there, but he couldn't afford it, so I'll tell myself about the miracle. It's not going to work. But when it comes to communication, you have to actually communicate. You have to actually get the message across. So therefore, that was lacking, and that has to actually happen to fulfill the idea. So the Paris Yosef HaChadash quotes this idea that concerning Moshe Rabbeinu, so for him, every mitzvah was like Pirsumei Nisa, because he felt that it was his job to display every mitzvah. As the teacher of Klal Yisrael, even regular, ordinary mitzvahs had a different status for him, had a status of being mefarsim, the concept. And therefore, he had to actually do it. He couldn't rely on onus rachmana patra. So therefore, to that extent, maybe that's why the Gemara Sota is telling us that he felt it was so necessary he had to actually perform these mitzvos. And that actually works well with this idea in the Medrash, that the only need to do that was because, as the teacher of Klal Yisrael, it was his role to actually do it. But if he wasn't going to be the teacher of Klal Yisrael anymore, if he was going to be retired, so then it wouldn't be his responsibility, so essentially he didn't have to keep pushing to be able to take on that role. It no longer would have been connected to what was motivating him in the first place. So, you know, a lumdish approach, but at least maybe that can be one way to relate to that medrash. And we'll just to close this part, we'll say a few words about Rosh Hashanah. But just to close this part, so the whole structure here, Asher Ma'altem Bi, Below Kidashtem, right? So there's a double structure here. That you offended me, you did something wrong, and you did not sanctify me. So the Meshech Chachma has a comment over here, very relevant to this time of year, to the impending Aser Sumei Tshuva, that he bases on the words of the Vilna Gaon. There's a well-known statement of the Vilna Gaon that we talk about nowadays, this time of year, we talk about a concept of Din V'Cheshbon. So what does that mean, Din V'Cheshbon? Double phrase. So what is din and what is cheshbon? So some explain, this is a different explanation, some say that it means that the din is what you did wrong, and the cheshbon is the thinking that got you to that place. That everyone who sins because they have some kind of a messed up cheshbon, because they make a calculation in their mind, oh, if I rob a bank, I'll be richer, I'll be a happier person, or whatever it is, they have some kind of calculation that leads them astray, so that's also a part of it. But the more well-known interpretation is that of the Vilna Gaon. Vilna Gaon says that it refers to the din is the Avera, and the Cheshbon is what you could have been doing had you not been doing that Avera. So that's the calculation, that's the bill, so to speak. So the din is the punishment for whatever avera it is we're talking about. And had you not been doing that avera, you could have been, had you not been out robbing a bank, then you could have been doing some tremendous act of chesed. So you have to give a din for robbing the bank, and you have a cheshbon for the lack of chesed that you could have been doing during that time. And the Meshech Chachma applies that here. He says that's this dual language. You did two things wrong. One, you did something offensive, ma'altambi, and also you missed lokidashtem. You missed that you didn't sanctify me. So that's a dual part of what creates the problem here. So this is already very relevant to the whole idea of the Seres Meshuvah, the whole concept of Din V'Cheshbon. But also this idea specifically might be the key, as some Svarim point out, to understanding the whole nature of the Seres Meshuvah. Because the Seres Meshuvah, it's a difficult concept, because if the notion is that we need to get things in balance, that we are afraid that we are not going to get a good judgment because we're banging them and we need to be tzaddikim, and it's 50-50, and we need to tilt the balance. So why do we have the Aser Simei Tshuva? Tshuva is pretty hard. Right? Why don't we have the Aser Simei Mitzvah? Just have people go out there in mitzvah tanks and do an act of kindness, do some kind of mitzvah, and you will tilt the balance that way. If we're 50-50 and you need to push things over the edge, so let's do mitzvahs instead of tshuva, it's probably much, much easier. So why don't we do that? Why do we have the Aser HaSimei Tshuva? If that's our whole goal, why don't we just have the Aser HaSimei Mitzvah instead, and that will be a much simpler path towards winning the din. So among the suggestions that you find is that tshuva is particularly available during this time. We say, Dirshu Hashem bi matzah, we should seek out God when He is available, when He is accessible. And when is that true? That's true during the Asaras Yamim, Shebein Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippurim. So if one were to fail to do that, if one were to pass up the opportunity for tshuva during this time, that itself would be a failing, that itself would deserve an accounting, and that would push things so far in the other direction, that would be very hard to overcome. So this whole mentality of not only din, the din v'cheshbon, that on the one hand we need to do the right thing, and we need not to do the wrong thing, and we need to also make sure that we're doing what we could be doing, the opportunities that we have. So to not take this opportunity for tshuva, to not seize upon God's closeness and to maximize what that holds out for us, that would be such an offense. It would be very hard for us to offset that with anything else. That's the suggestion number of the Bali Musar have. Okay, so just maybe I'll prolong this, just have a few minutes. Maybe we'll just mention one idea about Rosh Hashanah that happens to connect to something we discussed in the Shir about Sukkah, so it should have some kind of reinforcing effect. There is I'll just say this very briefly, we could spend much more time talking about this, but there is a major machlokas as to what the idea of the mitzvah of shofar is. Is the mitzvah of shofar to blow the shofar, or is the mitzvah of shofar to hear the shofar? So that apparently was a machlokas rishonim. Say apparently, because the Rush quotes this as a machlokas based on the question of what bracha do you make. Do you make a bracha that focuses on the language of tkiyas shofar, or a bracha that focuses on the language of shmias kol shofar? So we follow the view of the Rambam and the Rush that the Shmia wins out over Tekiah. But then the question is, if that's true, so why is it that there are requirements for who blows the shofar? If the mitzvah is just to hear the shofar, so let anyone blow the shofar. It doesn't have to be somebody who's obligated in the mitzvah. You could set up a computer program to blow a shofar. Why does it have to be that somebody who is obligated in the mitzvah of shofar is going to blow the shofar? And that's indeed the case. It has to be an adult Jewish male. Why is that necessary if the whole mitzvah is in the shmiah? So there are a number of approaches. I could basically break it down to six approaches. We'll see if we can mention them quickly without going into great detail about them. But one approach is take the other view, the view of Rabbeinu Tam, that maybe the mitzvah really is tkiya. So that would explain why we care who doesn't. But assuming that we don't follow that view, so we assume the mitzvah is shmiya, so then what other approaches can you take? So the Shagas Aryeh and many later Sfarim, they take the position that yes, the mitzvah is shmiya, but shmiya of what? Shmiya of something. So what should the shmiya be? The shmiya has to be of a kol shel chiyuv. You have to hear a sound that itself is infused with the character of mitzvah, the character of obligation. So if that's the case, so even though the mitzvah is on the hearing, but the shofar has to be blown by somebody who is obligated. And there it's interesting, in one contemporary sefer, the Sefer Yunim B'Halacha, raises the question that we've already discussed the fact that when it comes to a sukkah, so the mitzvah of sukkah is in the sitting and the living, and therefore the construction of the sukkah, as we discussed, I think on day one, right, the construction of sukkah can be basically by anybody. Sukkah is ganbach ksheira. So why don't we have a similar structure here also, that in the shofar the mitzvah is in the hearing. So therefore, the production of the sound, the blowing of the shofar, that can be done by anyone. So what he suggests is that it's different, that there is more of a connection to the generator in the case of shofar than in the case of sukkah. Because in the case of sukkah, so the sukkah is built by whoever builds it, and then that person could walk away, never come back, the sukkah is still there. The sukkah is going to stand on its own. But when it comes to a shofar, the person who blows the shofar, sound comes out. And if they stop blowing the shofar, so then no more sound comes out. The sound is only going to continue as long as the individual is continuously blowing the shofar. And therefore, when it comes to shofar, there's a greater connection to the one who's actually bringing it out there, and that's what's necessary to make it a kol shel chiyuv. Okay, could be. But that's a second approach to why we care who blows the shofar. There are a few other approaches as well. Rav Shechter quotes from Rav Soloveitchik, and he makes many nafkaminas based on this. Maybe one that we'll have an opportunity to recount later in the year. We'll talk about other sukkah issues that we haven't discussed yet. But it suggests that when it comes to various mitzvos, there is a split sometimes between the action and the fulfillment. That most mitzvos of the Torah, vast majority of mitzvos, you perform them and you fulfill them at the same time. So I pick up a lulav, I fulfill the mitzvah of lulav at that moment. But there's a handful of mitzvos where you do an action, and that action is not the actual kiyum ha-mitzvah. The kiyum ha-mitzvah is somewhere else. It's often the case when it comes to more emotionally based mitzvos. So we have a mitzvah of Simchas Yontif. And Simchas Yontif, the way we perform that nowadays is by eating meat and drinking wine, buying new clothes. So Rav Soloveitchik and others noted that really the idea is an emotional commandment. The mitzvah is Samachta B'Chagecha. The mitzvah is to be joyous. But we can't really turn on and off emotions like that. If we're commanded to do it, it doesn't really work practically. So therefore, the mitzvah formulates itself as do a certain action that is likely to bring about that requisite emotion. So therefore, Simchas Yontif, we eat good food, and the likelihood is that that will provoke an attitude of simcha, and that's where the kiyum ha-mitzvah is. Could also be, just to mention this now because of its timeliness as well, that might be the pshat when it comes to tshuva, because the Rambam has a language which the Mefarshim have a hard time with. In the very beginning of Hilchos Tshuva, the Rambam says, what's the mitzvah of tshuva? The mitzvah is that kishi yasa adam tshuva, when a person wants, or kishi yasha, when a person wants to do tshuva, she yisvadeh, that he should say the vidui. So it sounds like the mitzvah is the vidui, not the tshuva. So that causes a lot of discussion in the Sfarim. And there, Soloveitchik commented also that no, the mitzvah is tshuva. But tshuva is an internal shift of attitude. So that's not something you can just turn on and turn off. So we need some action which correlates to tshuva. And that's the maisa ha-mitzvah. So vidui is a statement. That's something which is likely to trigger feelings of regret and of change. and therefore vidui is the maisa, and the internal change is the kiyum. So you have that kind of a duality with a number of mitzvos. So maybe here also the mitzvah of shofar is really hearing the shofar, but the kiyum, the fulfillment, is there, but the action of the mitzvah is to blow the shofar. So maybe that's why there is the split, but that's also a part of the mitzvah. It's the maisa mitzvah, and therefore you need somebody who's chayiv in the mitzvah to perform that. There is a similar approach using different terminology, so we'll count it as a separate one, that the Abdi Nezer, the Sachchav Rebbe, has, that he suggests that really the mitzvah is really about hearing the shofar, but every mitzvah has to have some action. We don't have mitzvahs that just happen passively. There always has to be some kind of a pu'ula. So therefore, the pu'ula is the blowing of the shofar. But the mitzvah itself really is in the hearing, but because we need there to be an action, so blowing the shofar also takes on some mitzvah status. It says, but we still make the bracha on the shmiyah, because that's what really represents the theme of the mitzvah. And then he goes on to say, that's why there's a practice to cover up the shofar until the mitzvah is finished, until the bracha is finished, rather. Because, just like we cover up challah Friday night, why do we do that? Because we're going to make kiddush on the wine. And we could have made kiddush on the challah. So we don't want to offend the challah. So we cover up the challah and we make the kiddush on the wine. So to here, we could have made the bracha on the shofar itself, on the tefillah shofar. But because we find the mitzvah really to lie in the concept of hearing it, so therefore we want to use that for the bracha, so we don't want the shofar to be offended, so we cover that up during the bracha. Menachem Salazar very much didn't like that approach. He thought it was wrong. He said there's Kabbalistic reasons why we cover up the shofar. If that was really the reason, we should cover up the shofar blower. He didn't like that whole approach. So as a fifth approach, that it's simply 50-50, that there's two halves to the mitzvah. The mitzvah is made up both of tekiah and of shmiah, and they both contribute to the mitzvah. As a final approach, which here's where there's a little bit of chazari here, that you could say based on the nitziv, right? Remember the nitziv we mentioned on day one, that sukkah, the whole discussion of whether sukkah and its creation, is that a mitzvah or not? So the nitziv innovated this idea of a hechsher mitzvah haksuva b'kra, right? A little bit of chazara, right? A mitzvah that is not a mitzvah itself is a preparation act for a mitzvah, really called a hechsher mitzvah, but it's not something which is meaningless as far as a mitzvah status is concerned. It still is significant because, especially, it's mentioned in the Chumash. So that we saw has various nafkaminas, including the possibility that you make a bracha on such a thing. That was the view of the Yerushalmi. And a few other possible significances. So we could say here also that maybe that's a good description of what Tkiah Shofar is. That maybe Tkiah Shofar is not the mitzvah. The mitzvah is Shmias Kol Shofar. But Tkiah Shofar is, on the one hand, a Hechsher mitzvah. And it's a Hechsher mitzvah that is more than a normal Hechsher mitzvah because it's mentioned in Chumash, and therefore it has this elevated status of a Hechsher mitzvah haksuva b'kra. So that gives us six different ways to view the structure of the mitzvah of shofar. Is the mitzvah of shofar in the blowing or in the hearing or somewhere in between? But we saw that most of these views really seem to emphasize the hearing of the shofar as the goal. And the Rush quotes in the Mishnah Rosh Hashanah that seems to make that point pretty clearly, because the Mishnah Rosh Hashanah, which has become one of the most important sources for the question of electronic sounds and fulfilling mitzvahs through microphones and telephones and the like. So the Mishnah says that if somebody is blowing a shofar in the middle of a pit and he wants to know, is a Yotzei shofar? So the Mishnah says, depends, that if called shofar, Shama Yotzei. That if he hears the sound of the shofar, he's Yotzei. But if he hears the sound of an echo, then he's not Yotzei. So many poskim assume that the microphone sound is like the sound of an echo. It's a recreation of the sound, and therefore it's comparable to this scenario where you're not Yotzei. It's a whole separate discussion. But the Rush, talking before electricity, the Rush says that Mishnah shows you that even the person who's himself blowing the shofar, he only fulfills the mitzvah through hearing. If he heard a different sound, he's not going to be yotze, even though he is blowing the shofar. So that should show you that the mitzvah is shmiya. So why should the mitzvah really be shmiya? Why is that so much more significant? So Rabbi Ganak discusses this in a Sefer Gan Shoshanim, where he suggests that we know the Rambam has a very famous line. If I'm not mistaken, our new president, Rabbi Ari Berman, wrote an article about this line of the Rambam that was printed in Tradition many years ago. I think I spoke about it in Rosh Hashanah once. That's a very worthwhile article, where the focus is on the Rambam's line, Hofos Tshuva, that the Rambam says that when it comes to shofar, even though shofar is a gzeirah, it's a din in the Torah, which we just have to do no matter what, but the Rambam says this, the symbolism, rem is the yeshbo, there's a symbolism in it, and that symbolism is, what's the Rambam say? The shofar is meant to be an alarm clock. Uru yishenim yishenostem, that those of you who are sleeping, wake up, the shofar is coming to rouse you out of your patterns, out of your routines, and to wake you up, and that's the message. So if that's the case, so it makes sense that the shofar is kind of supposed to hit us from the outside. It's not something that we do, it's something that is supposed to affect us, happen to us. And that even the one who is himself blowing the shofar in shul, even he is fulfilling the mitzvah, not through that part, not through the blowing of it, but through the hearing of his own blowing the shofar, because that's the whole nature of the mitzvah. The mitzvah is meant to hit us from the outside, it's meant to impact us, and to wake us up. So hopefully some of these themes will be able to give us a little more of context as we approach this Rosh Hashanah, and hopefully the shofar and everything that surrounds it will have the impact that we need it to, and we should all merit that our din and cheshbon is effective and beneficial for us, and that we should be zocha to a year of chaim, a year of bracha, a year of simcha, a year of mazel, and all the things that we want for ourselves and HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants for us, all of that should come true and should be declared for us as we welcome in the new year. So we'll just daven mincha now, and after that I will see you guys next year. See you, God willing, on Sunday, where I assume we'll continue with Sukkah and Yom. All right, who'd like to daven for us? Leib, if you want to daven. No? Mr. Breshman, okay, then you're up. Actually, I should have been sound for a little bit.